And we are recording. And I'm delighted to have with me today Anna Krivoshich, who's a low-carb and keto advocate, a recovering yo-yo dieter that struggles with her relationship with food and herself most days, according to Anna herself. So welcome.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. I really appreciate it. And I first became aware of you on Twitter and Dan Grief's Facebook group and on Clubhouse, where we would chat a little bit. And I asked you on for a few reasons, but maybe the foremost being just how much of a success you've had with your health by changing the way you eat. Mm-hmm. So it'd be really good if you could just tell your story up till now, really.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it started in 1991. But yeah, no, I've always struggled with my relationship with food. My family, Serbo Croat, so very Eastern European influence of food is everything. So, you know, we celebrate food, we are angry at food, we're a food heavy family. But also my family run a hotel, so we've always been busy. It's always been business first, personal needs last. So as a child, my relationship with food was always really strained. I used to binge eat quite a lot, and I just very, just sort of, to an extent, disordered eating, where you just sort of eat when you could, and when, you know, like for example, every time you sit down for a meal, the phone would ring or somebody would be at reception, and you just didn't have that work-life balance of, you know, that food-life balance to an extent. And that led to me being overweight as a teenager. And me obviously then developing mental health issues around that as well, and just general self-image issues. And then obviously when I started going to school, I used to get bullied for various things, and that all added to it. And then I would sort of find myself in a pattern of, you know, I'd have breakfast at home, and then on the way to school, I'd go to McDonald's and have McDonald's breakfast as well. And then I'd also stock up on snacks and have things to eat, like, as comfort whilst I'm in school. And then on the way back from school, I'd pick up loads of snacks because I'd come home and I'd have a strained relationship with my parents. So I'd have my quick, I'd like grab everything from the dinner table, eat food in my room behind the computer where I'm escaping onto the internet, and then snack on, like, you know, brownies, juice, all this high sugar, high carb stuff that at the time I was completely unaware of while piling on the pounds. It got to a point where I was about, I think, 17, after a lot of sort of, to an extent, emotional blackmailing from my family, where they'd be trying to be controlling, because obviously they could see, like, in the most loving way possible, they could see that I was gaining weight and it was bad for me, and they just didn't have the means to communicate with me and to educate me to live better, because they themselves couldn't do it either. So when I was 17, I discovered Lighter Life, a very low calorie meal replacement diet, essentially. And I thought, give that a go. And I'd gone from, I think at that point, I'd gone from something like, I want to say 17 or 19 stone down to about 14, 15 stone. And then I'd gone to uni, and it was all like this whole brand new world of, oh my God, you've lost weight, you're a new person, you finally got freedom from your family. Oh man, don't worry, I've got this. You know, like, yeah, we did some CBT around the, you know, around the mental health side of food and our approaches to food and why we eat and why we overeat and why we reach for food and things like that. And that was really, really helpful at the start, because there were things that I was completely alien to and things that you don't get taught at school. But then I got to uni and I was like, that's all right, I got this, don't worry. I got this. Domino's pizza every week, drunk, because, you know, that's what you do 5 days a week. You go out clubbing and you drink and you eat crap. And again, the weight started piling back on. And then a few years later, I was like, okay, need to, you know, deal with this again. Went back to Lighter Life. And at this point, I think I got up to 21 stone. And then, you know, I was miserable at this point, because I vowed I'd never get that far again. But I got to about 21 stone and I was like, no, need to do something about it. I'm not happy. I need to take action. Went back to Lighter Life because, you know, that worked. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's 500 calories a day and a very restrictive diet. And it was not, you know, there was no leniency. There was, you know, you have your three milkshakes, your one bar, that is it. You can only have that if you have any.
Like 7 days a week.
7 days a week. Like, you, I don't know if you're familiar with it at all, but it was 7 days a week. They are very, they are rigid. They are very, very much, oh, you even thought about any other food, how dare you? And yeah, you would go to weekly meetings and you would deal with, you know, the idea was great, but it's a very, very toxic diet culture. And I'm not here to bash any company, and I do appreciate that it did work. It did work. But it was not sustainable for me. And I ended up losing, that time I'd lost 10 stone in 6 months, which I can see from your face is a lot. And not even, you know, without seeing your face, that is a lot. 10 stone in 6 months is an insane amount. Combined with the stress of being in uni, the stress of, you know, still finding yourself, you know, you're going out and you end up navigating through bad habits, you know, through being at uni, not looking after yourself, not sleeping properly. I then eventually got diagnosed with epilepsy in 2012, so almost 10 years ago now. They couldn't attribute what it is. No one in my family has ever had epilepsy. You know, they're like, okay, well, you have been on a very calorie-restricted diet, and yeah, okay, they claim that you're getting all your vitamins and minerals and you've got all your recommended daily allowance, everything is perfect, but something isn't right. So was it the diet? Was it my poor looking after myself? Was it something that's, you know, an inherited gene, but I was the first person to activate it? Nobody really knows, and to this day I will never know. But suddenly Light to Life wanted nothing to do with me. Because part of anything, if you look at, for example, themselves, Cambridge diet, Slim and Save, all of these very low calorie meal replacement diets, one of the check boxes is, do you have epilepsy? If so, you can't be on it. Why is that? I never asked the question. I just sort of went, okay, fair enough. You know, has the doctor approved? Yeah, okay, tick that box. Nobody needs to know that the doctor doesn't care. I haven't spoken to a doctor. I've just got on with it because doctors don't listen to you. Because doctors have always told me in the past, oh, you're overweight. And I think this could probably resonate with a lot of people is, oh, you're overweight. Eat less, exercise more. Whereas they wouldn't turn around to someone, or maybe they do. And if they do, that's even more tragic for someone who's underweight and say, eat more and exercise less. There's never been that sort of help for people who binge eat, people who have that unhealthy relationship with food in general. Like, I've went to, over the years, I've been to so many group meetings and things like that for people who struggle with food. And I've seen that there is just a lack of help and understanding for people who struggle with disordered eating. Anyway, moving back on to Light to Life, I went back to them and I was like, hey, this has happened. I was getting to a point where I was about maybe about half a stone away from my target weight. And at that point, it was very numbers focused. You come in every week, you'd have your weigh-in, you'd have your meeting where you talk about food and you talk about everything and, you know, your relationship and the mental health side of things, as I've already mentioned. And then you go on to a maintenance plan where you slowly reintroduce food. And again, it would be like a low-carb approach, but you're slowly reintroducing food and you're supposed to be able to go into maintenance. But these things, in my personal opinion, are designed for failure. As you can probably tell by the fact that I did it once, came back, did it again after having gained more weight than I'd originally started with, and then come back and now developed a neurological disease, essentially. And when I said that, they're like, well, unfortunately, despite all the money that you've invested, because at the end of the day, I was paying, with increasing prices over the years, I was paying about £70 a week to have an eating disorder. and I was, you know, you rationalise this because you're like, well, I'm desperate and I probably spend way more than £70 a week on takeaways and groceries. So you're like, okay, that's £70 a week. That's, you know, they to an extent, again, I don't want to bash any company, but they manipulate it in such a way that you're like, less than a pound a meal? Wow, I'm saving so much money and I'm losing weight and everything is great. And you get, you know, like, oh, you've lost so much weight. Wow, proud of you. The fact that you've lost so much weight because you've been physically ill. Like, I've seen people who've been on, like, Slimming World, people who've talked about, you know, they've gained Slimmer of the Week when actually they had a horrible illness or a stomach bug and they got Slimmer of the Week by having not eaten that week. And that is a horrible mindset to be promoting to people, and it's scary. But moving back onto Lights of Life, they turned around to me and they were just like, I'm afraid that we can't be associated with you anymore. We wish you the best of luck. And I was like, how much money have I invested over the years? And you're not even going to put me into maintenance? No, I'm afraid, because of the epilepsy, the terms and conditions. And I was just like, okay, well, I'm here at the deep end now. I've just been diagnosed with a life-changing illness. I've just lost so much weight that I, at this point, I still thought I needed to lose a lot of weight. Like, I'm not particularly tall. My BMI was still showing me, and I think as BMI is another topic that we need to get onto, I think, later. My BMI was still showing me as overweight. And that was purely because I had so much excess skin, which, you know, and I wasn't building muscle, and I was just, you know, holding on as that. So, yeah, I'd lost loads of weight, but if you looked at my face, I was gaunt. I looked unhealthy. People were turning around to me and saying, okay, you've done too much now. And I'm like, no, I haven't reached 140 pounds. I need to get to 140 pounds. I need to get to that. No, you don't. No, you don't, little Anna. You need to go back and learn to appreciate yourself. You need to learn that it's not all about that number on the scale. Anyway, they let me go. I just started the epilepsy medication. I was really, really struggling because the dosages were off, and you know, I was given the epilepsy medication. I was given three options. I was given one that would give you a 30% chance of having abnormal children. Now, I don't plan on having children anytime soon, but I didn't want to reduce that poor little kid's chances just in case from the get-go. The second option would have had a really severe increased chance in depression and suicidal tendencies. These are things that I've already struggled with, so I didn't want to add to that factor. And the third was, oh, you might get a really bad rash. And I was like, I will take that chance. I was like, the lesser of three evils, I will take the rash and I will run with it. Luckily, I didn't have any of those symptoms, but regardless, I still developed terrible issues with my mental health, and my depression got a lot worse, and there was no one there to help. And you go to your doctor, and eventually you turn back to food because you trust food. Food was always there for me. Food was there for me when I couldn't talk to my parents. Food was there for me when I was being bullied. Food was there for me through everything. So I went to food, and I eventually got back up to 27.5 stone. Which is a humongous amount for anyone in their early 20s or anyone full stop. Again, this is not for lack of trying, for yo-yo dieting in between, and you try everything. You tried, like, as a kid, I tried Atkins. I just tried everything. Like, you name it, I've probably given it a go, as is probably true of many people in this, like, toxic diet industry culture that we live in. But eventually it got to the point where I was so unhealthy. I had so many problems with my joints. I was just miserable. I couldn't leave the house. I didn't leave the house for about 2 months because I was so depressed. And all I would do is eat takeaways 2-3 times a day. And I was struggling in uni. I was genuinely just, I'd let myself go and I was unhappy. And eventually something hit and I discovered throughout those phases, I discovered Slim and Save, which is like a watered down version of Lighter Life. So it's still restrictive, very low calorie diet, but it offers a variety of plans, and you don't have to have it, you know, it's all online, so you don't have to go in and speak to someone. You don't have to, you know, you've got Facebook groups and support groups, and they're just as rigid as they were on Lighter Life. but they're not, you know, you don't have to physically go for a doctor, you don't have to sign any forms, you just got to, like, tick a few boxes of consent and it's all well and good. You lie, I don't have epilepsy, not a problem, I just want to lose weight, it's going to be great, I know it works. Back onto that restrictive scenario. But they say, oh, you know, they teach you a little bit more. They're like, oh, you try to get your body into ketosis, you want to remain under 70 grams of carbs. Anybody who knows anything about ketosis, 70 grams of carbs is pushing it. It's getting yourself into that limit where you're just sort of there, so you're hooked. You have to follow the plan because you can have, you know, three packs or two, you know, two soups and a bar and a small low-carb meal, but they're very restrictive. There's no fun involved. There's no teaching you about MCTs, good fats, and good proteins, bad proteins. It's not teaching you anything about the nutritional value. It just goes, meet these guidelines in this specific data form and you'll be okay. And again, that didn't work. But slowly, because of that, I started to learn about keto, about low carb. I started doing that research myself, and I realized, hold on, it'll take a bit more effort, but I can do this myself. And that's where I discovered keto and tried to do that sort of more rigidly. And I finally got myself down to, I don't know what the exact weight was, but I lost about 12 and a half stone. And I was healthy, I started exercising, I enjoyed exercising more importantly. And like even now, like with lockdown, I miss going to the gym, you know, it's a big thing. But it's something that past that I would never have even considered. Like if you told me that told me 10 years ago that I'd miss going to the gym, then like you're off the laugh. But it's a huge change in me, and I learned a lot about myself and about nutrition. It's something that I now carry on and try and teach others, because people tar low carb with this like ridiculous brush of it's a cult, as you know we've discussed the other day in the WhatsApp group. But it's a scary world, and it's just learning to navigate it and what works best for me. And you know, over lockdown, I've gained some weight, and I'm not ashamed of that. I'm aware of that. I'm now trying to lose that, not because I want the number on the scale to be better, but because I've found a level of discomfort, because my clothes don't fit properly, my thighs are rubbing a little bit closer together, and it's not that perfect image that I want to have a thigh gap. It's just that I feel uncomfortable. It takes me a little bit more to get up the stairs. That's not a way I want to live my life. It's not sustainable. And I guess here we are today, and I've waffled on for a long, long time, but I think we've pretty much got up to date.
That's great. You know, what a great story with real highs and lows. I mean, I certainly carried a few extra stone, but I didn't have, and I've certainly struggled with disordered eating, but I can't imagine what it's like to, you know, reach these highs, lose a lot of it, and then it sort of seems to be snatched away from you again.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, there's a lot in there. I guess something you mentioned about CBT being useful. You know, mm-hmm. I guess some of the people who attack low carb, they'd say, well, it doesn't matter how you lose weight as long as you lose the weight. And
exactly.
let's pretend that's true for a second, because I think it's clear that on average over a population, there are some ways of eating which are more enjoyable and sustainable than others. But to what extent do you think CBT and the psychological aspect, the self-talk, is how important is that overall?
For me, I think it's hugely important. I think it's one of the most important things. I think calorie restriction, food restriction, just generally any sort of restriction is all well and good to a point, but it's not sustainable. Like, you know, I may have decided that carbs aren't for me and I'm never going to touch pasta. I say never say never, but I've decided to avoid these things because of how they affect my body. But ultimately, it's not about that. I can choose any diet I want. I can choose to follow any lifestyle I want. I haven't dealt with those inner demons. And that's a very important thing, is to deal with why we turn to food, just as any addiction, why do we turn to food? Why do we turn to that food specifically? What comfort is that food bringing me? And what hole am I trying to fill? Am I ever going to fill that hole? There's all these questions that go unanswered, and there's, like I said, it's a lack of funding, a lack of support for mental health and disordered eating, and so much pressure being put on people by social media and just even mainstream media of you have to look a certain way or you are somehow less valuable and you are an inferior person. That's not true. Everybody is equally as valid and valuable a person as the next person. You may make some mistakes along the way, and these are things you need to grow from. And if you don't put that time and that effort into your mental health, into your behaviours around food, you will always be stuck in that cycle. And that's what caught me all these times, is I'm looking for a quick fix approach. And that's what people want. You get sold this dream, you get sold this, you know, invest X amount of money and you will be fine. Everything will be okay. It's like when people talk about, you know, getting the gastric band, and everyone says, oh, did you get that? That must be the only way that you lost that much weight. No, that's not the only way. Okay, it works for some, and I'm not a doctor. I'm not here to tell anybody what to do with their lives, but I've seen the positives and the negatives of that. I've seen people who really regret that choice. And it's not something that ever crossed my mind. It's almost like when you look at antidepressants as a kid, I always used to think, no, that's for people who can't do it themselves. Eventually I understood that actually, no, I have a chemical imbalance. Actually, maybe I do need this. Actually, maybe there's more to it. Yeah, okay, medicine doesn't fix everything, but I do have to tackle all those other demons behind the scenes. But ultimately, it's a two-pronged approach. You want to take all the help that's available, and you've got to make an assessment based on the information that's out there. And there is a lot of information out there, but people choose to be ignorant, and that breaks my heart.
Yeah, it's obviously a complicated kind of pie chart about where the blame for why we have disordered eating and obesity, where all that comes from. And I think you said something very profound about...
Well, I said something profound.
Yeah, I'm sorry to accuse you of such a thing. if you're asking these questions of yourself, one of them might be, is this hole that I'm trying to fill even fillable? And yeah. I think facing up to that is really hard. And to me, that's, you know, it kind of, the more I spend time with people who get a lot from low carb because it's a sort of long-term sustainable solution, and because the community is filled with people who have helped themselves in that way, the more I realize that this addictive component to eating is really key in understanding how to make a sustainable way of eating. And I think that's why I think there's a mechanism in low carb that protects against addiction anyway. You know, you deliberately get rid of the addictive foods in a kind of all or nothing, cold turkey type of way, which I think for, you know, if you look at Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, that's really the only way that they've found that can help. It's, you wouldn't tell someone who smokes cigarettes to enjoy them in moderation. That's just obviously absurd. But I think the thing that you touched on that all of these diet plans get right is that they have meetings.
Yeah,
I think weigh-ins are grotesque, actually. Yeah, but actually, mm-hmm. I think the community aspect is vital for helping people to navigate really negative emotions around food, especially if they originally came from interactions with other people. You know, like what a messed up kind of thought pathway to get into, where you're being bullied for your weight and you're dealing with it by doing something that will negatively impact your weight. Mm-hmm. What a negative cycle to be in. I mean, have you found that the meetings are a big component of it as well?
Or the sure. I the meetings really helps, but also they also inspire a lot of negative thoughts. Like if I went back into my books, I could find you all the things that were really useful, and you're teaching yourself things about, like I said before, it's your approach to food and why you eat and what triggers you have, and it's that CBT aspect that I so required from my own personal mental health struggles that I found really useful, because it's like, oh my God, hold on, I'm eating because this person said something to me that really upset me, and it's my solace, it's my comfort. Hold on, maybe I can learn to approach this. Now I have all the tools, but I still can't stop myself from doing these things. I still can't stop myself from taking action on all these triggers. And it's that missing piece, isn't it? It's, you haven't got the meetings are great, but you haven't got that overwhelming, positive, aspirational, progressive, sustainable voice that tells you that it will be okay. And you need to not be harsh on yourself. And you need to just go with the flow. You will have fluctuations in your weight. It's not about your weight. It's how you feel. It's how comfortable you are in your body. I am now technically obese again. Yeah, probably still obese. I'm definitely still obese. And, you know, I've had skin reduction surgeries, which is probably something we should get onto eventually. That I was very lucky to have funded by the NHS, which I thought would never happen for me, because obviously I gained and lost so much weight in so many times that my skin has seen better days. And that brings upon a whole issue with your self-image and your self-worth, which was pretty bad to begin with. And you lack that in these meetings because they're so goal oriented. It's, you know, smart goals. It's making, how can we achieve? Yeah. And it's that toxic positivity to an extent. It's like, we must achieve. It's like everyone's been talking over lockdown. It's like, oh, well, I did this today and I did that today. Great. Good for you. I'm really pleased for you. But some of us are really struggling, and seeing that is only making it worse. And some of us just need to be told that, you know, yeah, okay, it's a struggle, but you'll get there. How can I help you? How are you today? And you don't get that. You get, I've lost a lot of friends over the lockdown period. In the last year, I've lost a lot of people who couldn't cope anymore. And that itself is heartbreaking, because you have people who, you know, whether it be related to food or whatever it is, or finances, people are not coping, and it's a systematic failure. And again, like I said, again, it just breaks my heart.
Yeah, the support thing's key all round, isn't it? And I had Andrew Jenkinson on the podcast, a laparoscopic surgeon who meets people at the end of the journey where they need gastric bypass surgery. And so he wrote a book about why people got into that situation, and you know, the stories quite often sound very similar to yours, where people yo-yo diet because they're promised a solution,
an attainable goal.
Exactly. And all you do is you notch your set point, your weight set point up a little bit every time because you're starving yourself. And he's a big advocate of lower carb. And, you know, I guess it's brilliant that you got the surgery. I think that's the right thing. You know, I think that's the compassionate thing. I think it's the caring thing for a health service to do, especially a health service that lets people down.
Yeah, I see. I was so lucky with that, because when I was still in the process of this, I still lived in Cardiff, because that's where I went to uni, and I ended up living there for almost 10 years. And I love Wales, a spiritual home. But my GPs over there said we can look into it, because I was like, you know, what are the chances of, once I've lost this weight, that I could, because my issue was, because I ended up having an abdominoplasty, And I ended up having two surgeries, essentially just the tummy tuck. That wasn't my priority because I was like, my stomach, I can wear Spanx. I can cover it up. My issue is my arms. My biggest issue has always been my arms because I gain weight in my arms. I lose weight in my arms. My arms sag. No amount of exercise, no amount of, you know, looking into autophagy and everything that else that comes up in you know, this weird world we live in. No amount of anything will fix that. I wanted to get my arms sorted. And the first time I'd gone to, this is, you know, I think it was my second big loss of life to life. And I'd gone to a consultation with a plastic surgeon in Cardiff. And that was utter chaos. And this was a private consult. And I went in and I left thinking I was a piece of crap. He was literally like, oh, okay, so one arm's bigger than the other. Oh, okay, so we're going to need to do that. Oh, actually, well, you know, I've done over 3,000 breast implants, but I've only done 3 brachioplasties. And I'm like, I don't really want to trust you, to be honest, because you're obviously not capable of doing this. And you just made me feel like a terrible person because I've gone out of my way to lose weight. And the image you portrayed of me is like, oh, and then we can work on this, and then we can work on that. And I was like, I'm not going to give you money to reduce my self-worth even more than it already is. Goodbye, thank you very much. And then we moved on, and like I said, got back into that cycle, gained more weight, lost more weight. And finally, when I moved back to London, going back to Cardiff, my GP had said it's unlikely because Wales doesn't have the funding. And this is something that I've seen is very true for a lot of people who have been in similar situations, who happen to live in Wales or in lesser funded parts of the country. There isn't that funding. There isn't that option. They just go, oh, well, we can plead a case, but it depends on the board of directors and whether or not they think it's true and whether or not they think you're a valid candidate. Whereas I'm very, very lucky that I won the postcode lottery in London. My family live in Hammersmith. I was born and raised in Hammersmith, so I come down under the Imperial College Trust. So I've got Chelsea Westminster Hospital, Charing Cross Hospital, and St Mary's Hospital, which are amazing, amazing hospitals. I went to Chelsea and Westminster. Well, I went to my GP when I first moved back to London, and I said, hey, this is my first meeting with this GP. And I just said, hey, this is me. I've just moved here. Just want to, you know, make a new GP surgery. This is my story. Could you possibly think about, you know, what help do you think might be there for my arms? And she was amazing. And oddly enough, I think she was just about to retire. And I don't know if it was, you know, she was retiring and she was angry at her job and wanted to help people, or she just was leaving and she just wanted to make as much, you know, as much of a difference as she could before she left. But when I went to meet with my surgeon, he was like, you must have a very good relationship with your doctor. I was like, what do you mean? I literally just met her. She's like, she wrote you a glowing recommendation on how you need this surgery. And, you know, within months, literally months, where I was told this would be a life, like a upward struggle, I would have to fight for this. Within months, I was seen by a top surgeon and I was scheduled for surgery, and I've had 2 surgeries so far and I've never looked back, and it absolutely changed my life.
And that's brilliant.
It's incredible. But I'm lucky because of where I live. I'm lucky because I live in Hammersmith, which is close to Kensington and Chelsea, which has much more finance. Other people don't have that luxury.
I guess what would be nice in the longer term is to help people to not get into that position in the first place.
Exactly.
And I wonder, do you think if you were armed with the right information when you were a teenager, mm-hmm. you know, so you said you tried Atkins, but, you know, obviously there's a lot of competing voices, you know, about whether that's healthy or safe or effective. if someone had come along and said to you what you know now with authority, or you know several people had, or it was in the culture where if you noticed disordered eating and rapid weight gain and feeling bad about yourself in that respect, that eating low carb would be very likely to help a lot, then do you think you would have acted on that? It's a hard question to, it's a hard hypothetical, but I do wonder, you know, is this the kind of information that we should be giving out, or is it more about the emotional side?
A bit of both. So for me, it was, my brother didn't want to see me ruining my life. So it was my brother who discovered Atkins, and my brother who said, this is an approach that we should be taking, because he noticed that in my family, we struggle with weight. We struggle with food. Like I said earlier, you know, we've got an Eastern European approach. We food is everything, you know. Every day is, like, our dinner table is a feast every day. There is no, like, we've cooked enough food for how many people there are. It's a feast every day, and we've got leftovers, and we're going to eat them for the next 3 weeks. You know, that's fantastic, but it's unhealthy. But it's a culture, and you can't, you know, like my dad's always said about my mum, bless her, I love my mum, I adore her, but she's a very difficult person to be around and difficult person to educate in terms of food. You can take the man out of the village, but you can't take the village out of the man. And that is so, so true. I was always told and almost bullied by my brother to, you know, lose weight, you have to lose weight, you have to do this, you have to do that. And it was controlling, and it was horrible. And I know that he had the best intentions, he just didn't go about it the correct way. But if, as a kid, or when I was in school, somebody had actually said to me, these are all these foods, these are how these foods work on your body, and gave you that information for you to make an appropriate decision. Like, even today I see GPs prescribing statins to people with diabetes when they could just, don't type 2 diabetes, when they could just teach them to reverse it. Like, my dad is stubborn as a mule, but after seeing me do keto and just generally live low carb, and you wouldn't listen to me, but when I said, hey dad, here's this book by this doctor, Jason Fung. Yeah, Diabetes Code. Check him out. He's really, really clever. Really clever. You want to read him? He was like, oh, I don't know about that. And then found some videos, you know, Dr. Berg and all these other various doctors and things like that. I fed it to him. Slowly but surely made him think it was his idea. And eventually he was like, that's a good idea. That isolation low carb thing is a really good idea. Now, he's stubborn. He loves snacking. He will never, and to this day, he will never follow it per se. But he eventually got into a sort of state of intermittent fasting and low carb, and he reversed his diabetes in 3 months. Like, he hated statins because he refused to take medicine. My family are all very anti-medicine and anti-vax, and it's, especially in the current climate, it's a horrible topic to be around. And you know, they can't be taught these things, but given the tools and given, you know, being told that you know, maybe it's their idea, they're slowly coming around to it. And I feel like if, as a child, somebody would have given me those tools and made it more readily available and said to me in school, instead of, you know, like, oh, you have to have your 5 a day, you have to have this, and all these, like, traditional concepts that we have around food, of, you know, like, I've got that standard image of that plate that, you know, has to have potatoes and meat and salad and veg, and it's like, that's not true of everyone. Everybody's different. Everybody's bodies react differently. Like, we've developed gluten intolerances. We've developed diabetes. We've developed all of these various things. People need to be educated on the fact that these things exist, and not just told that, oh, well, there's only one way of eating, and if you don't follow that, that's it, you're a loser. So I remember growing up, I'd see people who were, you know, vegetarian or vegan, and they'd be like, oh, you pretentious person, you, oh, look at you, fancy vegan, oh, look at you, gluten free, obviously we've gone a lot further, you know, today, and I've learned that some of my best friends are vegans and vegetarians, and I can now actually cook for them, and it's amazing. But it's something that inherently we're told is wrong, and we're inherently told that any different kind of eating is wrong. Why is that? Why are we being told, why are we telling people how to eat and what to eat and telling them the wrong things? And how do we push out that message, and how do we prevent it from happening in the future?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, like, it's obviously very difficult to give a message which is consistent with the scientific data and that gets through the filters that are required to get into policy. That takes 20 or 30 years and usually a lot of spending by special interest groups which might not have the best interests of the population's health at heart. So, and then the emotional side is almost just as difficult, because it's really difficult for you know, teachers and other caregivers to notice everyone and take time to care for everyone on that level. Neither solution is perfect, I suppose, but both play a huge part. And what you said about, you know, good information and understanding and allowing people to find their own path, I totally agree with. And it makes me wonder about toxicity in the diet world in general, and we can talk about that, but why don't we start with any toxicity in the low carb world? You know, it can be a bit of an exclusive club.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. There is, you know, and this is stemming back from, for example, we go to the Slim and Save again. Like I said, I'm not bashing any groups, but the Slim and Save Facebook groups is like, okay, so you can eat certain things. So you can have, you know, one meal a day if you're in, I can't remember what the names of the plans were, but it was basically like a, you could have your 3 packs and one meal, and your one meal had to be bland. And it was like, you could have steamed vegetable and a steamed piece of chicken and like an egg. And it's like, lovely, great, can't wait to live my life like this forever. And you just don't, you're not inspired by it. And, you know, it wasn't sustainable, but you'd have these toxic voices who would, you know, push this narrative of you must do it this way and there's only one way to do it. And if you do not follow our rules, we will kick you out of the group. And I saw that happen. Anybody who thought for themselves would be, you know, that's it. No, how dare you? You have a thought that doesn't align with our constructs. And then, no, goodbye. And that is toxic. And that's what teaches people who, you know, not to say that I'm somehow more intellectual than others, but there are people who do not have that information there and have not necessarily, like, I was raised in a very sort of every day's a school day household. Like, my dad has taught me that you must learn every day and you must progress every day. So I'm always, always looking for ways to learn and improve and progress. Some people just don't have that ambition. Some people are just content in the way that they are. You know, ignorance is bliss. And not to say that's a bad thing, because, you know, do what you want and whatever makes you happy. But these people are easily influenced, because all they need is a toxic voice of someone to say, hey, I've got all the solutions. I will fix all your problems, because that person's a little bit unhappy, but they haven't thought for themselves to Google it, to search it, to, you know, the science is out there. The information is out there. You just need to be willing and realize that it's available to you. Like, I remember when I was in school and I was applying for universities and stuff, and I was lucky that my parents had put me into a good private school and I was given the opportunities and I was told that I could achieve. But my cousins who went to public school, again, not shaming public schools, they're amazing, they deserve more funding, they didn't even realize that was on their agenda. And that is a horrible thing to think of, is that there's so many people, because at the end of the day, I was in a place of privilege. There are so many people in this world who, unless they've got somebody fighting their corner, do not know that they can achieve and they can do better and they can learn. And they don't have to be any set criteria. And again, going back to what I've said multiple times, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, and it's doubly heartbreaking when you're in a group which is meant to be supportive, mm-hmm. and you're having people being berated for stepping out of line or mm-hmm. whatever the perceived offence is.
Yeah,
I guess it's unavoidable, and it's not particularly it's unavoidable, and it's ubiquitous. You know, in any group you look in, you can find people otherizing and saying, you know, they think this, they're morons, and we don't respect them.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's reciprocated by the other group. So what I try and focus on is the positive aspects of what people have done with low carb, but acknowledge that there are things that work for some better than others, or some things that might be a myth. But I like to try to give information to people in a non-judgmental way, you know?
Exactly. And that's so important, because, you know, like I mentioned in the WhatsApp group the other week, you know, somebody posted on Twitter, "Just want to warn you that keto is a cult," or something to that effect. And I just went, I lost it, completely lost it. And I retweeted in the exact same pattern as they did, which is, "Just want to let you know that you can make informed decisions for yourself." And this inspired a debate. Turns out that person had actually just seen a friend get into the toxic side of keto and the toxic side of low carb and the monitoring and regulating, and everything has to be done in a specific rigid way. And eventually we found common ground. She was just caring for her friend, and she was just trying to be supportive, and she didn't want to see other people fall into that trap, but she went about it the wrong way. Whereas, again, I don't want to say, you know, I'm high and almighty, but I said, "I appreciate your views. Can you please appreciate mine? Can you please appreciate the science around it? Can you please appreciate the good? Yes, there is bad, but the good cannot be tarred with that same brush just because there are negatives." Like in any, you know, there's always going to be a black sheep in any group. And it's navigating away from that and realizing that not everything is negative. And like, I've always been negative, and I've been raised in a negative, cynical, you know, expect the worst but hope for the best environment. And I think that in itself has made a huge impact on my mental health. And I'm trying, and I've, you know, over the last 2 years, I've grown a lot just through introspection and journaling and just mindfulness and, you know, yoga, meditation, and just generally looking after yourself to see that you can be positive and you can manifest good, and you can just expect better things for yourself. And I think that's just really important.
Yeah, it's a nice message. You know, there's something about the old saying of, in a, you know, if you're talking about prison wardens and mm-hmm. prisoners, who's really behind the bars? You know, if you spend time with ideas that are unpleasant, and they're bound to rub off on you.
Yeah.
And I think accentuating the positive side of it is really important. Do you think your involvement in hospitality and the nighttime economy had anything to do with the kind of continued poor relationship with food, or do you think that really just was a side issue?
A bit of both. I mean, obviously, working in hospitality, I've always grown up with, every morning you have to feed everybody, every morning you have to feed. And then obviously you're so busy during the day that you don't have time to have structured meals, because you always get distracted. And I've never learned, like, I remember one of the first things, like, going back to Lighter Life, was looking at your meal and realizing not to be distracted when you're eating, to actually look at your plate and digest what you're eating instead of just waffling it. Because like we're quick eaters in my household. Like I watch my mum howl down food, whereas my 95-year-old granddad, he's taking his time and he's full. And we've got to encourage him to eat because he's 95 and he's getting on a bit and he's losing a bit of, you know, muscle mass, and we need to encourage him to eat more. But also, we don't want to bully him into eating more than he's capable of. But also, we don't want him to lose weight and, you know, become frail. But it's finding that time to eat and allocating time to eat and appreciating food, because food is medicine to an extent. It's not, you know, food is for sustenance. It's not for, you know, it's not to be messed around with. Like I think if we treated food like medicine, we have it at certain times, we have it for certain needs. Like I know that if I'm, you know, if I'm lacking in fiber, I need to go and eat some more leafy greens. I know that if I'm lacking in X, Y, Z, I need to eat this or that. And I eat things that I now know, because I've done the research, I know what works for me and what I need to eat and what I should eat when I'm feeling a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I've worked in hospitality in the nighttime economy myself, and certainly becomes much harder to time your meals properly, I think, especially when you're the one serving the meals usually.
Yeah, and you're sitting there and it's hard not to pick. You know, like every morning, like I mentioned to you this morning, you know, every morning you wake up and you've got to prepare, you know, 30 or 40 croissants and bread rolls. And you're like, they smell good. I'll have one of those. And you make a couple of extra because, you know, you might have an extra guest who shows up. And then you're that extra guest. And then you stuff it full of bacon. You stuff it full of cheese. You load it on the butter. And yes, yeah, delicious. But you've had all of that before you've even had breakfast. You go, it's okay because I'm on my feet. It's fine. I'm counteracting it. You know, it's that in and out calorific deficit. It wasn't the case. You're just slacking. You are just eating because it's there, because you can see it. And then, you know, you're feeding all these people, and then you end up at a point where you realize that you're actually doing yourself more harm than good.
So what are you looking ahead to now? You've come so far and you've found something that seems pretty sustainable and that you like and that you're comfy with. What's kind of your aspiration with it all?
At the moment, I've gained a few lockdown pounds, and that's something that I hate the narrative around it, especially with the new restrictions the new roadmap that has been released, of everyone going, June 21st, we're all going to go out. Oh, we need to lose this weight. We need to lose that. No, you don't. You need to just, you know, there is no beach body. There is a body at the beach. You know, you don't have to do anything. You just need to do what works for you. So for me, it's getting back into, I've got a fantastic personal trainer, Marissa. She's started, obviously with lockdown, she started doing an online sort of membership. So you've got various classes, but you can do it all at home. And that's what inspires me. It's, I need somebody to sort of be my cheerleader, to be like, hey, come on, come do this. And it's getting back into fitness, especially now that the weather's getting better, is starting to walk more, take the dog out for walks. It's not my dog, but I take it for walks anyway. Eating better, which I've done already. Like I've already lost a few pounds, but again, I don't want to focus on the pounds. I don't want to focus on that. I check the weight, because I got into a horrible addiction of weighing myself 20 times a day. Like I had scales in the kitchen. So every time I went into the kitchen, I would weigh myself before I would eat. That's a horrible trait. You should weigh yourself once a week, once a month, if that. Measurements, clothing is the way to decide whether or not you are happy, or, you know, whatever stable weight you want to be. for me, it's getting back into my fun clothes. Being it is starting to, you know, like, I noticed a huge one is over lockdown is people stop wearing bras because you're like, why am I wearing a bra? What's the point? Where am I going? And turns out that restriction and that holding you at your ribs is what reminded you that you don't need to eat. Because now that I've made an active choice of wearing a bra every day, I'm eating less. Because
interesting.
Like, it's absolutely mad. Like, I was like, I'd say, okay, I'll wear a sports bra, it'll be fine. I'll wear, like, a bralette. Like, obviously, you're probably not that well-informed in terms of bras and, you know. But having that restriction there, which is a little bit tighter, reminded me that, actually, I'm eating too much. Getting dressed instead of wearing joggers every day and being in loungewear, getting dressed and putting on a pair of leggings and a pair of jeans and realizing that, hold on, my clothes don't actually fit properly. What have I done here? It's little changes, sustainable changes, positive self-image, being kind to myself, moving on. Eventually, I want to get my surgery on my arms. I don't know how feasible that is. I know that my surgeon said that she wanted to do, because obviously she did the tummy tuck at the bottom half, but my upper half still needs doing because I've still got sort of that barrel around my back and sort of underneath my breasts. And it's just, it's uncomfortable. It's unhygienic for me personally. But she wanted to try and see if she could do, you know, manipulate the system in a way that she could get me in, but I needed to fit a certain category and I need to get to a certain weight. And because of various things, I gained weight, so I couldn't do it. But I know that option is always there. So I need to get myself healthy, I need to get myself fit and just see where it goes and hopefully move on, because I know the surgery's in my future. And even if I have to do them privately, then that's something I have to invest in because I'm not happy. But I want to be happy in myself, and you know, everyone has ups and downs, and it's realizing that it's not, happiness isn't like a constant. You don't achieve a goal. It's not like I've achieved happy, great, I'm happy forever now. It's fluctuations, up and down. You will or you won't. You just got to ride with it and just hope for the best.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you've traveled such a way along that road, and that you've got a really exciting set of prospects for the future. Where can people find you online if they want to?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram and Clubhouse as Anna VK. Pretty sure that's me. Eventually I am starting, this is another thing that we should have touched upon that I never got around to, is the self-sabotage, is that I've been wanting to, for the last 10 years, start my own website, my own blog, sort of like a lifestyle blog, and more of a sort of portfolio of everything I'm capable of, because I've got, my background is in fashion marketing, my degrees are in fashion marketing and international business. And these are sort of the aspects that I want to move into. And I'm starting that off. So eventually I'll be on annavk.xyz because I have to be quirky. But for now, that's me.
All right, brilliant. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. And yeah, sure. And I'm looking forward to seeing your continued success.
Thank you very much. And yours.
Thanks, Anna.
Thanks, Anna.
Thanks a lot.